Accession number 13717, Lieutenant Colonel Charles G. Reel 3.
Colonel G, Reel 3. Now, we were talking about when you'd become adjutant in the 9th Battalion in 1917. Could you tell me what your... We've discussed some of the work of the office. What were your first impressions when you actually met Bradford? We haven't dealt with that
yet. I think rather frightening and impressive, young, and... I think very impressive.
What was so impressive about him?
I gathered, I had been told, that he always, if he punished anybody, always gave the maximum punishment, 28 days, and that he knew them all by name and spent a lot of time talking to them. Certainly in the trenches, he spent all day with them. I hardly saw him. Some of the night.
You say he was frightening.
What?
You say he was frightening. What was so frightening?
Well, he could tick people off. He ticked me off enough. I can't remember making any serious mistakes, but I got ticked off an awful lot.
How would he do it? I mean,
my writing. Well, he'd surely rude. Very rude often.
Would he swear at you?
No, I don't. Not more than bloody, I mean, not seriously. And we used to call him. I don't know. I think if he was cross about something, he probably took it out on me. I don't know. Because I can't remember making any mistakes.
What sort of thing would he say to you?
I don't know what your mother would think of you and so on. Well, it's a nasty remark. She'd made twice doing this, and I didn't answer by saying she's dead, but I avoided that. But he was difficult, and the betting was that I wouldn't last a month. But
you say he was difficult. I mean, was he a? He was an impressive man,
very
and
impressive
a frightening man. But was he a nice man?
Oh, that's very nice. I think very
well,
nice.
What sort of qualities did he have then, other than his military?
Well, that's your charm. The first time I can picture it, he was acting brigadier, or the brigadier was on leave, and he walked back into the camp the next morning, and I was going round to do something. Absolute charm. And I might have been the most efficient adjutant of the world, and best friend, charm, and the same thing. At the end, when he was wounded coming back, just before he was made a brigadier, there was something that go along with the rations, and he came past and the son and said, "Oh, well, it's all right, you'll do it." But normally, there'd been an awful row if anything had gone wrong at the front line with the rations. It wasn't my fault, it was the transport or something had gone muddled.
You were with him a lot. Was he friendly to you?
Yes, terribly friendly. Fortunately, I don't know if I'd give a tip by anybody. I always treated him as a normal at supper and this and that. I'd get ticked off all day and either play a game with him or supper. I'd just treat him as an ordinary person. And he seemed to thrive on it.
Would he call you...
G.
Just G. And what would you call... You'd call him Sir, I presume?
I'd call him Sir, that's all, I think.
Did you find it funny? I mean, you say he looked very young. In pictures, he looks young. And he was only about 5 years older than you. Did you find it strange to have such a young colonel?
Well, yes, I don't know. I'd never seen colonels except old ones. No, I didn't find it strange. I felt that the battalion was very good, I'd gathered, and that he was... As I gathered from people, that it was unusual having a colonel of that age. And with a VC and MC, and everybody said he ought to have had lots more decorations. He did become a brevet. Was that a decoration? I think totally near the end, at the time of the battalion, that if the war ended now, he would go back to being a full lieutenant, who would be a brevet major when he was promoted captain, but he couldn't be promoted captain because all the captains were in safe employment. So he'd go back to be a full lieutenant from colonel or eventually brigadier.
Was he embittered by that?
Hmm?
Was he saying that with rancour or just...
Well, no. Well, yes, I was a bit worried. The same, of course, later in the war, later in the year, he said that to me. And he also wanted, got the idea that because there was nothing in civil life for him, it would be better to die in action.
He actually said that to you?
He said that to me, yes.
Once or on several occasions?
Once. No, no, it wasn't. He was actually devoted to the battalion, and he did make them enormously efficient, and I think he inspired me with the impression that we were as good as the guards.
That was with his, not only his example, but with his training experience.
Training experience, and he had more experience than anybody else in France. That was the impression I'd got when he produced the books and I learned from this book about him that he had big ambitions of teaching himself to speak in public and so on, to address the men and then later say goodbye to them and to address his new brigade when he got a brigade. And they all knew his name, and no other brigade in France knew the name of the brigadier, I don't suppose, because they never saw them. Montgomery did it, the Second War, copying Bradford.
Were you very impressed? I mean, he had a VC. I mean, they're very uncommon. Did that sort of thing awe you at all? When you first arrived, anyway?
I don't think so, because I knew a good bit about the war from my brother. Been in a year with three attacks on the Somme and so on. And he came to see us quite a lot in the summer of 17. My brother knew our divisional sign and used to get a day off, and the lorry hopped and he saw the visual side of us and come and find us. He came 20 times and had dinner with the colonel, especially his colonel was a stinker. I'd been sergeant major by battalion at the beginning of the war, and my colonel knew him. He was a real dad. That's what we go on to next, to the orderly room. I reckoned I worked 16 or 17 hours a day, or I was on standing to attention or eating or something.
You say you'd always give the maximum punishment. Was that, that can make you unpopular with the men, but that
well, and they were frightened, yes. He would be unpopular, but in the line they ceased to be. They were frightened of him.
Did he have a reputation that, I'm not putting this forward as my thoughts, of being a medal hunter or a glory hunter at all at the time? A medal hunter or a glory hunter?
Oh, no, not in the least. Not in the least. He wore a different uniform from anybody. He never wore a Sam Brown that I saw. He's wearing one in that photograph. Must have borrowed it.
What did he wear usually, then?
He wore a specially designed leather belt with two straps down here. I don't know how they fastened
on
the back. And he got arrested for it once in London on leave. But he didn't, or the man who was going to take him to the War Office or something, but on the way he found fault with the man taking him and said he'd arrest him. He got away with it.
Why the newly designed belt? I mean,
well, it wanted to be different, I think. And I think, really, looking back on it with hindsight, he wanted to be a corps commander. He told me if he was a corps commander, he'd use an umbrella. And he does, on one occasion, in the book on him, borrow an umbrella or do something. But it was rather essential to be important and different. And Montgomery found the same. He wore two cap badges.
Did, I mean, this thing, so he wasn't personally vain at all? Was he vain at all?
No, not at all, I think.
What, did some officers with that sort of reputation he got, you know, for courage and dash and the rest, they find that such officers can get a lot of the men killed by volunteering to put their battalion into it.
No.
He wasn't like that then?
No, he wasn't. No faults with it. He ought to have had a lot more.
He was careful with his men's lives then?
Oh, enormously. Enormously. And we practically, he wasn't careful when you're out of the line. I mean, we training, he wanted everybody to be, to go not up communication trenches, but walking and playing about with rifles and real ammunition, not sham, so that it would come easy. And he didn't worry him at all that an occasional bullet hit somebody.
What sort of training exercises would he have them on?
Pardon?
What sort of training exercises would he put the men through out of the line? Would you see much of it, or would you be in your office?
Rapid firing, all sorts of things. Fairly ordinary, but when we went on the range, overhead fire from machine guns, men in the...
While the men were firing, they'd have overhead machine gun fire on them.
On what alleged enemy. People in the butts putting up targets and taking them down and so on. And people got so excited they started firing rifle grenades at the butts of their own men were in it. And that particular day we were on the field firing thing, I remember very well because I had a platoon there, I think, and things worked right. Grenades and knocked out the target if we wanted and so on. But it was very exciting. And we did quite a lot, some range, sort of rather bad range on the flat plain of France. Messages came in that said, bullets were frightening people on the main road. It wouldn't worry them at all. It just went on firing. Nobody did get hurt, but anybody else would have stopped it.
So his aim was to make training quite realistic.
Oh, yes.
Like they did in the Second World War, these two.
Yes, it didn't worry him at all. I remember somebody saying, not quite true, that we had more casualties training than we had holding the line, but it was very nearly true, because we got some new grenades and bombs, and these are all the old ones must be thrown. Company said, hundreds of the darn things that were old and not quite useless. And of course there was an accident and one or two people killed and one or two wounded. Somebody made a mosh of it, so one or two, those dudes. And the one or two people shot with practice on, they thought they had put the rifle bullet quite a long way. And you think the rifle is, if it should put that trigger, it should hit the ground. But we did have somebody killed with practicing loading. And of course, a rapid fire doesn't need practice. Remember, I was first commissioned firing 15 rounds in a minute. And I was determined to get 15 rounds done, and I did, and got quite a lot of balls accidentally. But I think somebody else must have fired at my target, because I didn't feel I was good.
Yeah, you mentioned that you had a platoon and that you were. So, as adjutant, you were still...
No, I think I must have got the time wrong. I think I was on the range with a platoon. I remember being very excited with that. But I was...
That was before you became adjutant.
It must have been before I became adjutant.
Just, again, look at... So, the training wasn't so much innovative as realistic.
Realistic. And hard. Long. And what with marching out to it and marching back and doing this sunbathing, which was not adequately done in Bradford's book. People didn't really get nude. They got their shirt off, and it was called a snapping parade, and they killed all the lice, which particularly down in the shirt there. Of course, some people get so many lice that they've got to be out of the army, practically, or left in there as a lice trap. It was clearly a good thing, and I remember learning that baths, which we ordinarily take in peacetime, are not essential at all. If you towel and rub yourself in the open air, it's just as good. You get the old skin off, and may not smell the same, but it's just as healthy.
Would Bradford give you advice like that?
Hmm?
Did that sort of thing come from Bradford, that advice?
I think so, yes.
The practicalities of
it. Yes. But he's quite right in the book. The skin disease in the men was awful, because they had a lot of them been on army rations only. Bully beef and biscuit for a long time. But frightful yellowy rashes on their back and sores and things.
And what was done to overcome them?
Nothing, I think. Well, every now and then they'd get a bath of some kind, I think. But this open air thing, I can't remember bathing, except 1918.
Did Bradford have a thing about people being out in the open air then? I haven't read.
Well, you know, being healthy. He and his family comes tremendously in the book. They're healthy games players of all kinds. Boxing, keep fit. Sort of religion with the whole family, and had been.
Did he try and inculcate that into the battalion then?
Well, keeping fit, yes, I think so.
And how did he try and keep you all fit? I mean, what sort of things would you do for that? Or was it just
training, marching, games of some sort. I mean, put people. One played for the officers against the men at soccer and so on. That was very bad. We rigged up a game a little like deck quoits, which I'd never played, but we made our quoit of wire and put some tape round it and caught sort of wire across or net or something, but it would mark out the ground, and you could throw it as hard as you could, and it would go in the other end. But it bruised your hand to catch it. But it was very, very good exercise. Wasn't fiddly at all. And the officers did that quite a lot. We played cricket occasionally. I remember playing cricket with no boundaries. You were sort of exhausted running 8 and 9 and so on. And the other man had hit.
Would Bradford play in these games? Or would he, I mean...
He didn't, that I remember, but he was keen on. He used to get his horse out and practice tent pegging and so on. I was watching him. I mean, sort of keeping civilian, keeping peacetime officers alive a bit.
Did he expect you officers to stay as fit as the men then?
Oh, I think so, yes. But it didn't, I don't think he made a point of it. It was just taken for granted, I think, you had to be fit.
What about when you were out of the line, was he very fussy about personal appearance? You mentioned about hair,
yes.
Has to be very short.
Very, very fussy about everything. A button undone, everybody, when he appeared, you checked your buttons, and so on. And he would, of course, I knew the tips, he'd, after a say people marching past, you would say, write to B Company and tell them to explain in writing for the information of the commanding officer why Private so-and-so had his left button undone. And I was supposed to fire off rude remarks like that every day. Of course, I only did it when I got an order, because, I mean, I never liked getting things explained in writing to the commanding officer.
So
they all got them occasionally. I had to do it sometimes, and he actually said so. but he expected me to do it a lot more, but I didn't.
So just as he sometimes...
I had to keep a what?
Just as he sometimes ignored orders from above, you'd sometimes ignore... Yes. Irrelevant,
well, I had to. Well, I've got to live with the officers, and they knew I was younger and quite inexperienced, and we lived all right. It was all right. And I was very complimented. One of them asked me to go on a holiday to Paris with him.
I'll come back to that. Well, this bit, he was fussy about buttons being done up and things, but would he expect the buttons to be polished out of the line?
Oh, no. But the men had to be shaved always in the line, even if it was a big sweat getting water. And the trenches had to be kept absolutely spotless, no cigarette ends on the ground or anything.
Now, just keeping it out of line. So although he did be very fussy about buttons being done up, he didn't have the idea that the spit and polish idea of bullying them up.
No.
He wouldn't insist on
that. It was efficiency.
That was his thing, efficiency,
yes, efficiency
rather
than
war.
Beat the enemy. And of course, tiredness, they had to be occupied in trenches. They'd get a little sleep in the night, they could get sleep in the day, but they mustn't get idle. And they had to do musketry practice in the trench as far as you could, and keep it absolutely spotless, and have a proper place for a lavatory, and do murder if...
So he was very strict on what they call trench discipline.
Yes, because other people got to come into the trench, so you might have to live in the trench for ages unless it was blown up by the enemy.
Would it even come down to like the lots of bully beef cans? I mean, would they be properly disposed and buried, or...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And men didn't wear putties. They wore a sandbag. And when it got wet or dirty, you changed it, you built it into the parapet. So in the line, and they all wore sandbags.
That was his idea. That's not usual, is it?
His idea. No, I don't think anybody did it, but it was jolly handy.
So they wound it. How did they wind it round?
They cost a lot of money, too, before the end of the year.
So they wind, would they wear the putties underneath?
I don't know how they put them on.
They wouldn't wear the putties as well?
No.
Just have a sandbag wrapped around their legs.
Yes, and we always had a lot of them. Remember, I had made myself a sandbag quilt. So dug a hole in the ground and crawled in at night with sandbag sort of quilt to keep me warm. Well, that's later. Efficiency.
So it was only, just to reiterate, it was efficiency but not the look of things.
No.
He was only bothered about things that made things more efficient rather than about the look of things.
Not worried about the look. Efficiency, the bed had been, it's part of discipline, having your buttons fastened and so
on. Saw that as a disciplinary measure rather than... He wasn't worried about the look of it.
Worried about the look,
it
I don't
think
at all.
It was the discipline, the self-discipline of keeping your buttons correct, but not shining them.
Being disciplined to beat the enemy. Everything was on that.
Did he say... Why was he so keen on it? Was it self-ambition?
Partly self-ambition, partly... we wouldn't have won the war unless there'd been a lot of people like that. And I do know that I and others made an appalling mistake in what used to be public school morality, that you mustn't report to anybody, mustn't sneak. And when an officer in my company, the company I was in, B Company, had to march in the afternoon and he was drunk, all the officers in the company swore he wasn't, they lied like troopers. They had to get me and somebody else as witnesses. Remember that happening. It's one of the grimmest things in my life, because I was walking with him in the front and this wretched officer was only about a yard behind and he kept giving the step just a little bit wrong.
Because he was drunk?
Yes. Well, I didn't know it was because he was a bloody fool. I knew he was a bloody fool and I knew that he was also almost never sober.
And this is in your first month?
Yes, it's adjutant, more or less. And he got tried for it. We had a halt on the way to one corps, probably. And I sat down, I was tired, and so it came and said, "The colonel wants you." And I went across to him, saluted him. And he said, is so-and-so, his officer said, is he drunk? I said, no reason. Don't think so. I went away and then watched him, and he was drunk, up into the shadow of doubt. But he sent for the company officers, and they all said, oh, no, he hasn't had anything to drink. And they lied. I didn't. I said, I had no reason to think so, except this thing that I'd heard before of other people giving the step a little wrong. And the colonel then made him walk in front of us. And by the time he'd walked a mile or two, he said, he practically bent double. And there wasn't a doubt, a shadow of doubt. But I do remember him also, his standard thing to everybody was, blood is thicker than water, and nobody must tell anybody anything. And he expected everybody to protect him. And he got tried for drunkenness. And
so you hadn't actually said he was drunk, you just said you didn't know.
I said I didn't know, but afterwards, of course I said he was drunk.
Afterwards you reported back to Bradford that he was drunk.
Yes, well, Bradford asked me, I said, of course he was drunk.
You say that broke public school morality, but on the other hand, it was... You felt you could justify it.
Well, no, I didn't know he was drunk until I looked at him carefully. Then, of course, I admitted he was drunk. He was obviously drunk.
But you say you felt bad about having done it, or you?
I didn't feel bad. I felt
was
bad.
Bradford very strict about drinking and drunk officers?
Yes. When I got there, he was trying to organise a strike against whiskey. So many officers were drinking so much whiskey and really living on it. And he didn't take it. I didn't like it personally, but he failed to organise a strike on it.
As colonel in the mess, he was trying to stamp it out, whiskey drinking.
And discourage it, and he tried, and a lot of people were taking, not necessarily in my unit, but taking too much. But
could he not just have banned it in the mess?
I don't think he could.
That would have been going outside his area.
I don't remember it. I think he may have banned it in the headquarter mess. We never had any other mess, I don't think, that summer.
So you were only in...
Yes.
He was trying to ban it in the company.
He was trying to ban it. He tried to get other units to. And a lot of doctors and people...
Did he drink anything himself? I mean...
I don't think anything.
He was teetotal?
I think he was teetotal. And I gather from the book he wasn't strictly teetotal, but he was scared of it. And...
Was he scared of it for himself, or scared of it for the effect
well,
on...
Well, people were taking too much, I think.
What about the mess that you were in? You mentioned it. It's a headquarters mess.
Headquarters mess.
So who would be in it?
Six officers. It would be the colonel, the second in command, the adjutant.
We've mentioned him before, but do you remember his name?
What?
The second in command. Do you remember his name?
Crouch. He became colonel the next year. I couldn't be woken up at night, any night.
Why not?
He'd had one whiskey too many.
So Bradford couldn't even keep his own... I mean, it had no effect on his second-in-command.
I don't know. But the second-in-command was there. He was probably difficult to wake up then. I don't know. But
you mean is when he became colonel?
When he became colonel, the next year, he couldn't wake him.
And who else? There's Bradford and Crouch.
Me, adjutant. Intelligence officer, Plummer.
Plummer was your old...
Plummer was my friend from school, yes.
He was the intelligence officer.
What?
He was the intelligence
officer, yes. And quartermaster, transport officer. I can't remember his name.
Now, how was the mess organised, or in and out of the line? I mean, it wouldn't be terribly formal, would it?
No, it would be very informal. I suppose it would be... a room in a house in the village and you're resting in the line and you're just food in a trench. We always lived in a trench.
Looking at it outside the line, so you just have a house, and what facilities would you have? You'd just be...
Well, it'd take over a room. I mean, the colonel would have a bedroom to himself sometimes, and the intelligence officer would be sent on ahead to the village, see how many beds were available, and he'd allot them in sort of seniority.
And so you might or might not.
We'd have somewhere a house. I mean, I remember the one in Germany, it was a padre's house.
But more in France, I mean, for the minute.
Yes.
And what would,
a room used as a mess, and there'd be six of us or whatever, six or seven of us sitting down to supper.
And who would prepare the supper? You'd have a cook, would you?
A cook. They had called a cook.
And was he any good?
No. And
what sort of food would you get out of the line?
I can't remember anything, bully beef. But I can't remember that. Later, I can remember.
Would you?
I criticised it a lot. And when the bloke went on leave, I was made to do his job.
That's later in the war.
Oh, yes.
Early on, there'd be not much else but bullet. What normal rations then?
The normal rations. More or less normal rations.
And the cook, would he be just a separate headquartered cook?
Yes, cook? I think so.
So he didn't have much chance with what he was given at the time?
No.